to tell your friends that in the introduction there, which was for Charlotte McConnell's benefit, supposedly, it very clearly says here on the CD, Donegal medley, and somehow we wound up over in Armagh, and we, in particular for Father's Day, we were burying the mother and sending her money and all kinds of things. Anyway, you're welcome, my friend. How are you?
Good morning, Adrian, and happy Father's Day to you and everybody who's out there with a father or is a father.
Okay, yeah, a grandfather, let's not.
Right, grandfathers are all welcome
and,
as well.
And a slew of reverend fathers. I mean, hey, let's cover the gamut here.
But Adrian, it's funny, when I listened to you, to that song that you just played there, first of all, I thought the whole thing was Donegal. Even though they mentioned Armagh, I was here in Donegal and
okay.
on the music. But in the last song, Goodbye Johnny Dear.
Yeah.
I mean, boy, is there ever a great song for emigration and emigrants? I mean, all of our great songs have that emigrant theme to them, you know, goodbye, you know, going away, long, and all that stuff.
You know, we might be able to see some humor in it with the passage of time, and you know, we very flippantly can refer to those songs as tear jerkers and whatever. Boy, they were not that funny for a period of time, you know, when I came to the country and, you know, through the 60s, 70s, when the possibility of returning home was a rare occasion.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I remember back in it had to be in the 50s, in Donegal, I lived up in the north end of Donegal, as Rosie and Lenihan says, the leafy side of Donegal, up in the Nishon. But my grandparents were down in West Donegal, and I remember clearly as a child going down and saying goodbye to my Uncle Paddy, who was off to New York to join another brother. And the consensus was we wouldn't be seeing him back again, you know, for years.
Right.
But, of course, 2 years later, the airline started, and they were all coming home in droves. So that ended the wake.
Yeah. And I think when you look back on it, and we were all very critical, obviously, at this stage of outrageous airfares and, you know, the high cost of international travel.
Right.
When the airlines did provide service overseas, that time, boy, that was they were not cheap. That was a kind of a you know, you paid dearly for what you got.
Right, but those of us then who were living in Ireland, as I was at that point, and would be for 20 more years or whatever, you know, we thought, oh my God, these Americans have their bundles of money. Sure, it's no problem to them to get on a plane and fly
Absolutely.
Over here. You know, so we wouldn't even have a clue of the hardship that many of those people had to endure to get those airfares and come back again. All we saw was the success of them.
Yeah. You know? And, you know, unfortunately, that would continue into the future and indeed to this very day.
Exactly.
I think that, and I'm not sure it's peculiar to Ireland, but we're, as I say, we're very good at it. A Yank arrives and, you know, cha-ching, cha-ching, you see that.
Absolutely. Well, you know, just in terms of the emigration theme, Adrian, as you know, we're going to have a lot of opportunities next week up at Quinnipiac University to look at all these different aspects of emigration, not only the emigration of our time, which, you know, I was recently in Donegal, and my sister is bidding farewell to her son who's off to Australia.
Right.
And you could sing that same song in that scenario.
Yes.
Because, you know, they're just heartbroken, you know. And but, you know, today, of course, you don't feel that it's a life sentence. Today, you know, they're going to be back maybe at Christmas or who knows what. But still, it's wrenching when emigration is still.
It is. And there is you know, the reality of the matter is there is a huge difference between what, you know, in early days, if you go back again to the 50s, 60s,
right.
Where, you know, you immigrated to England, you immigrated to Scotland,
right.
You could immigrate to America. Then, and I still find now, immigrating to Australia by default,
right,
has got to
right.
be one of something that young, highly educated people who are coming out ready for the world, it's a hell of a situation for, you know, for them to be in. Because
yeah.
if you talk to any of them, they do not consider this to be, you know, go and get some experience and all the crap that we listened to through the years from varied governments
right.
about how it was all good for us. And in fact, you know, how the Irish were born with the gene of wanderlust.
Right, right.
We better get the other side of that, because the reality of the matter is that this has very much to do with America and with the lunatic, our immigration,
right.
And the immigration yeah. reform, all, by the way, which was going to be sorted out, you know, as soon as we got a Democratic president.
Yes, well, we see how that worked out.
Yeah, we see how that worked
yeah.
out.
Well, the great news about the immigration conference that's coming up at Quinnipiac is that this is the first time that this conference has been held in the northeastern state.
Yeah.
Usually, you know, it's been ongoing for about 40 years now. It originated at the Ulster American Folk Park
mm-hmm.
in County Tyrone in Northern Ireland. And it always went, every 2 years, conference was held between Ulster and one of the southern states, you know,
mm-hmm.
because of the connections with the southern states, and primarily because it focused very much on a Scots-Irish population.
Right.
And so about, I started going to this conference about 6 years ago, and at that time, the leaders of the conference, you know, they knew that I was from the New York area and so forth, and so they had been very keen to try to move this conference to the Northeast, to tap into the great, you know, scholarship and, you know, and historians in this area.
Right.
So with that, we started thinking, how could we make this happen? And then, lo and behold, Quinnipiac emerged. And so we approached the Quinnipiac folks and said, would they be interested in convening this conference? And the timing was perfect because Quinnipiac had just opened the great the Ireland's Great Hunger Museum, which
right.
you are so familiar with, and you've been, you know, wonderful telling your listeners all about that. So the timing was right, so Quinnipiac gave the green light to proceed. So this is the first time this conference has been held north of the Dixie Line, which is very significant, and I think it's significant, too, in terms of the relationship between America and Northern Ireland and Ireland, thanks to the peace process. We must never forget
right.
the peace process is still in effect. Maybe shaky some days,
yeah.
but it's still in effect, and, you know, because that's still in effect, we can have these conversations that are very broad, that can talk about emigration from the famine days, and even before the famine days. There'll be historians there talking about emigration in the 1600s and the 1700s. And, you know, as you know, Adrian, the work I've just been doing on Archbishop John J. Hughes,
yes.
who came into this country in about 1812, now that's way before the famine.
Mm-hmm.
John J. Hughes and his whole family, they went down to northern Maryland and southern Pennsylvania, that area. So when I was doing the research on that, on this exhibition, which is up and running at the Irish Council.
At the Irish Council, yeah.
When I was doing the research on that, I was driving around there, you know, to see where he lived and see where he came in and all that stuff. And I was so fascinated by the fact that so many of the towns and villages and areas of that part of the United States had all these northern, well, not northern, but had these Ulster names. Names like, you know, like Strabane and Oma and Letterkenny.
Yes.
And all these Ulster names. So I was fascinated by this. You know, what was the connection? And then one of my colleagues working with me on the exhibition said that the state of Maryland was the first American state way back when, before anybody else got involved, to openly welcome English Catholics and Irish Catholics. So there was a kind of a path, if you will, a trail opened up between Ulster and the state of Maryland. And I had the great good fortune to speak to Governor Martin O'Malley, who I'm sure is a good friend of yours, about this. And, you know, it's just incredible to think that Ulster has such an imprint in that part of the country. Like, for example, where the great Battle of Gettysburg was fought, that area was called after the Getty family from Ulster. The Emmetsburg, of course, that was called after Robert Emmet. Mm. And you have just a slew of connections back to Ulster. So, you know, for me, it's just so exciting to find these links and these connections to Ireland and to see that they're, you know, that they went very, very deep. So John Hughes went down there, lived there, you know, was educated there until he became a priest and went off to Baltimore and Philadelphia and eventually became the fourth bishop of New York. But it's a great trail, and what will happen up in Connecticut next week at Quinnipiac will be a bunch of historians and academics, and you know I'm kind of neither. I'm a producer who pulls all of their best work together and has a chance to tell stories about it. But about 70, you know, very, very tried and true historians with great connections around the world will gather to talk about emigration, to talk about this ongoing story between Ireland and America particularly, but they'll also address Ireland and, you know, the rest of the world where, you know, I believe the diaspora claims something like 70 million people around the world have Irish connections of some sort. So that's all happening, and I would love your listeners to know that if they go online and, you know, just or go to Ireland's Great Hunger Institute, Google Ireland's Great Hunger Institute, they will get the details if they would like to come along, because one of the great things about these things, it's great to have historians come and give papers, but it's better if there's an audience there to listen to them. I mean, you know, people who like me just love to hear this kind of history told by professionals and experts.
Let me ask you, though, particularly at a symposium, how do you talk about Northern Ireland, in particular Ulster, and not wind up in, you know, a rather emotional, if not bitter, dispute? It would appear to me, anyway, being from Connacht, as I am, from once you move into Ulster, from once you move into the, you know, the Scotch-Irish area, there is plenty of room for the good old-fashioned Brit bashing, you know?
Well, this is always true in every Irish context. And, you know, in the context of everything, politics, land, the works.
Religion, way up there.
Yeah, particularly religion. I mean, the religious thing has been, you know, one of the things I saw with the Hughes exhibition was, I mean, this Hughes was driven by, and I'm not getting away from your question, I'm going to come back to your question, but Hughes was driven with such a deep, deep passion for education, because he was a man who was really furious that his government did not give him a proper education. Hughes is famous for saying, for the first 5 days of my life, I had the full benefit of my government, and then I was baptized. You know, Hughes was driven by that, and that's why when Hughes came here as a 19-year-old boy, young man from Ulster, and his house still stands, which is wonderful, in the Ulster American Folk Park. But Hughes came here, his whole thing was he demanded his own education, and then he demanded education for Catholics beyond that.
Apart from obviously being feisty,
right?
You're talking about an immigrant from Northern Ireland.
From Omagh.
Yeah. And somebody who came uneducated, with minimal education, who wound up actually not only being Archbishop right. of New York, but also somebody who was actually responsible, and I think many times we don't give him enough credit. He's the guy who actually is responsible for the building of St. Patrick's Cathedral.
And you know what, Adrian? The cathedral, as magnificent as the cathedral is, and it is magnificent, and it's having a restoration, and that was one of the reasons that I got involved with the story, is because they wanted to draw attention to the people who built that cathedral in the first place over 150 years ago. But the thing about Hughes was, Hughes also built the right for education for people who were not the established religion in this country at that time in the 1830s, which would have been a Protestant people.
Mm-hmm.
And Hughes was the person who was responsible for breaking through and making sure that Catholics, and it wasn't just Catholics he was interested in. He wanted that right to be extended to others who were non-Protestant,
right.
Including Jews and all others. So he was the first to kind of break through and create a new system of education, not only in New York, but that was going to then spread throughout the United States. So this man was a huge leader.
A huge leader, and talk about a motivator. He obviously, to fit that into a lifetime. What age was he when he died?
He was in his 60s. His health wasn't good in his 60s. So, young for us whippersnaps today at 60s. But he was in his 60s, and he was in poor health, but it didn't stop him. Just to show you what kind of an extraordinary man he was, Abraham Lincoln, the president, of course,
right.
and this was during the height of the Civil War, the president, Lincoln, sent Hughes to Britain and France as his emissary to keep the French and the British out of the Confederacy, out of the Civil War. So Hughes was, in addition to being, a feisty man, who was also known as Dagger John,
Dagger John.
But he was a supreme diplomat. He knew how to get things done. And so he went off and did the tour in Britain and Ireland and the Papal States and France. He also stopped in Ireland at that point. Mm. And they say he was there at the laying of the cornerstone for the new University of Dublin at that stage. He was a guest of honor at that. But the point is that he was there as a skilled diplomat to do that. And then he came back to New York. And, of course, when he got back to New York, his last civic act was stopping the draft riots. He went out on the balcony of his home and spoke to the crowd and reminded them that the Irish were people of peace. And he dispersed the crowd. And that was and then shortly after that, he died. But it would be 10 more years before St. Patrick's was completed because the Civil War took all the money away.
Right.
But it was completed by Hugh's successor, who became the first American cardinal, whose name was Cardinal McCloskey.
Mm-hmm. My guest friend is Turner McConnell, who is president and CEO of Turner McConnell Communications. And just to go through your bio would burn up a lot of time, but you have actually, as we are speaking about, you are the curator and in fact the producer of a monumental legacy, Archbishop John J. Hughes and the building of St. Patrick, which is and continues to run at the Irish Consulate in New York, and actually that's going to be running there until July 31st. Now, a lot of people, might want, to see that. I find it to be wildly impressive in the sense that, we barely skimmed the surface of this monumental, Ulster man who wind up, not only... becoming a priest and and obviously, but getting the ear of the President of the United States. But I think the production, which is playing at the Irish Consulate, might be something that many would not realize is open to the public. And actually,
right,
you can gather open. More, and you can, you know, learn more, you know, by you know, tour in that consulate.
Right. Well, people, you know, the public, we're very, very, very lucky to have a terrific Irish consulate in New York.
I know.
That's all about, you know, really bringing us together as a community. And nobody does it better than our consulate general. And this current one, Noel Kilkenny, much loved by the
brilliant,
entire community, who sadly we're losing in August. He's
right.
going to be Ireland's, he's appointed Ireland's ambassador to Greece. But we'll get another consul general, and they've just been extraordinary, one after the other. I don't know how, where they find them. But
I don't know how you can raise the bar, but the Kilkennys, and this is probably the first time that in my memory anywhere, where Hanora O'Day Kilkenny,
right.
is tongue-in-cheek referred to, you know, as the co-consul.
Right, right. Well, I'm very proud to say that Quinnipiac University a few weeks ago conferred on both Noel and Hanora doctorates from the university for their outstanding service to the Irish-American community for the past 4 years. So that's how well-regarded they both are. You know, and God bless them for all the great work they're doing. But anybody who would like to see the exhibition at the consulate, of course, it's by appointment only because it
right.
is a working consulate, so they have all kinds of things going on. But they're so accommodating, and we have a team of volunteer guides who know about these things and who have been fantastic people who will be there to welcome anybody who really just wants to see the exhibition
right.
and hear more about it. They will be welcome there, and in order to reach them by email, simply just send an email to info@turlomcconnell.com, and that's turlomcconnell.com. And or if they want to call you know they're not online,
mm-hmm.
they want to call, they can call the consulate, 212-319-2555, and then the extension is 0.
Okay.
And they leave a message, they will be attended to. Somebody will get back to them and invite them, and it's their story, it's our story, and it's meant to be, you know, a story told and experienced by as many people as we can. And it's been great up there, because we've been
mm-hmm.
up there since March, and hopefully it will continue. It will continue through, and not hopefully, the plan is to continue it through the end of July.
Yeah.
But I'll tell you, Adrian, after that, I have great hopes that, you know, John J. Hughes will be honored, not just in this exhibition, but will be honored in New York, and we'll probably have some plans coming next year
mm-hmm.
about the Basilica at St. Patrick's Old Cathedral down in Little Italy, where John J. Hughes worked from.
Yeah.
That's where he planned St. Patrick's Uptown, where they thought he was crazy building a cathedral 3 miles outside of New York, which was the current location on 51st Street. But he worked from downtown, and next year they'll be starting to create a Hughes Center, a John J. Hughes Center. And
mm-hmm.
so all this work that we've done will be put to good use on a permanent basis. People will, you know, he will be part of the New York visible scene where we'll get a better opportunity to see him ongoing. So that's down the road a bit, but we'll come on your program to talk about that on another day. But in the meantime, the Ulster American Heritage Symposium starts on Wednesday. It runs 3 days. We have a bunch of historians. Adrian, hopefully we're going to see you along the way somewhere
absolutely.
In there.
Absolutely.
And, you know, and we're going to explore. These brilliant historians will be exploring all aspects of the emigration, including the very important one that you mentioned was how do you explore anything to do with emigration in Ulster without touching on the political issues. Mm-hmm. Well, you don't. You have to touch on the political issues.
Yeah, and actually, Ireland, how do you talk about Ireland?
Yeah, but the good news is that Ireland now is at a place where you can have this conversation.
Right.
Thanks to the peace process, thanks to what happened 20 years ago. You know, to every, you included, Adrian, everybody who played a part in opening up the dialogue. Opening up the dialogue, you can now have these conversations about everything. And, you know, once you do open up these conversations, extraordinary things happen. I remember 1997 was the first year that the Irish government started to speak openly about the famine. And now, Adrian, you played a huge part in that because you helped to create the famine memorial in Lower Manhattan.
In Battery Park City, yeah.
Yeah, which
incidentally...
Well, I remember 1997... Yeah. I got a commission from the Irish government to host a tour with as many as six historians on behalf of the Irish government who wanted a tour in the United States, who the Irish government wanted to tell America what the Irish government was doing to commemorate the 150th anniversary of Black 47, the worst year of the famine.
Yeah.
And I remember going on that tour, you know, to various cities. Minister Avril Doyle was kind of like the anchor for the tour. She was the host.
Mm-hmm.
And we would go to cities like Chicago, Atlanta, San Francisco, whatever. And I cannot tell you how many people who came up to me who had claimed Scots-Irish background, who were so grateful that they could be in an environment where they could talk about their history as well.
I just want to double back to... Ireland's Great Hunger Museum in Battery Park City. You know, when that was, one of the steps there, and we can thank many people for their contributions there, particularly, Dr. Maureen Murphy of Hofstra University, in terms of the, and yourself, in terms of researching what amounts to a mile of quotations.
Right.
That sounds like an exaggeration, but actually if you do, with many, many quotations from Jagger John, and again from the Archbishop John Hughes.
Right.
One in particular, and I'm paraphrasing, says, which is significant coming from a cleric of his significance and his vintage of saying in terms of Trevelyan and, the stealing of Trevelyan's corn. Here's John Hughes, Archbishop of New York, saying, a man's first obligation is to his family. Pretty much condoning, you do what you have to do, but you're responsible for your family. To have that coming at that period of time must have been a little, that was a bit raw.
Well, I'll tell you, not only was it a bit raw, first of all, Maureen Murphy, our great historian Maureen, is going to be a keynote speaker at the Quinnipiac Symposium.
Delighted.
Yeah, Maureen will be there, and course, all of this is under the great directorship of the Professor Christine Keneally.
Mm-hmm.
So it's Christine who's pulled the whole academic end of this together, so she's amazing with this. But done on the hunger, these quotations, Hughes was very raw. Hughes was so raw, in fact, that he was politically igniting a consciousness in Ireland that had kind of diminished after the death of Daniel O'Connell. Because the word was started, first of all, Hughes was very inspired and driven by the tremendous work of Daniel O'Connell, the great liberator. So Hughes, in a way, was politicized by O'Connell, So he was fearless on his quest for justice for Catholics, as O'Connell was. But after O'Connell's death, and Hughes then was the Archbishop of New York, he had a huge city that suddenly, overnight in 1845 onwards, exploded and doubled with population, mostly Irish famine immigrants. And so he was a man of incredible power and prestige. So his words were listened to back in Ireland. Back in Ireland. Now, there are many historians, Christine would be one of them, who would say that he then sort of revolutionized thinking in Ireland, particularly on the issue of famine. He was the first to call famine this, you know, a political act.
Mm-hmm.
And so Hughes was responsible for a lot of that. So I would say when, you know, next 2 years when we start getting into the commemoration of 1916 and the Easter Rebellion, you're going to see a lot of those links to the Easter Rebellion coming from New York, coming from Hughes and other people here who were, you know, were politicizing in their speeches and in their writings, were inspiring leaders in Ireland at that stage. So there's a lot of that going on. So that'll be something that we're going to see more of as we get into the commemorations of 1916.
One of the reasons that we put you on early in the program is that there is no end to the amount of information which, and indeed, it can be said that in many instances, you know, you see something, you go after it, and you see it through. And even for, you know, your own friends like myself, one has to, you know, with the advent of calling ID, you have to say, Jesus, do I really need to speak? Because you have, you know, over a couple of decades, you've actually opened a lot of doors, and to, you know, to say that you, you know, are an advisor to about everything that happens from the Irish aspect of Quinnipiac University, from you know, the museum, Ireland's Great Hunger Institute, and now, of course, the Ulster American Symposium. A lot of things that have taken place are because of your, again, scratching the door until that door is open.
Well, I feel some days like John the Baptist. I just have to hang on to my head.
Yeah, I actually, that's great that you should mention John the Baptist. You know, I kind of think of, you know, the dog at the door who's scratching because he wants to get in.
Oh, that's me, Adrian.
Peeing rain outside. And anyway, no, I want to though, while we're at it, to cover another aspect of something that you've been widely involved in, your filming documentary, multimedia products. You're a producer. You're also a writer. But tell us about the documentary films, particularly. You know, the Brian P. Burns collection of Irish paintings, Portrait of a People. We didn't hear much about, definitely didn't hear much about, you know, Brian P. Burns and his collection of paintings. That would have been, you know, somewhat for the rich and famous, for the arty type.
Right.
But those have been, just give us a
well, a nutshell, or a snapshot, is that Brian Burns, I met Brian Burns about 25 years ago or something like that, and I knew about him because, you know, I make it my business to find out who's doing stuff, Adrian, as you do. You know, I make it my business to find out who's doing things that I care about, you know, who's dealing with Irish culture, who's telling, and this all comes out of the peace process. I mean, I got here when I was, you know, 21. And I came right from Donegal, northwest, very touched by Northern Ireland. Derry is my city, even though I'm not allowed to call it my city, mm-hmm. because I grew up on the other side of the border, but it is my city. And, you know, so I was very informed by that. And I gravitated towards people like you and Neil O'Dowd and Patricia Hardy, you know, who were telling the truth about what was going on in Ireland. And, you know, so I've always kind of looked out for those people who are telling the truth about Ireland. And Brian Burns came on my radar because I was familiar with the Burns Library in Boston, where Brian had set up that, endowed that library in the name of his father.
Yeah.
It was, like, he wasn't the son of the man who did it. He was the son. This is a great tribute on Father's Day to talk about Brian Burns and his father. But Brian did it in honor of his father. And it's established a great scholarship there and what have you. But Burns himself, as a young man, he started to collect paintings. And he started to collect Irish paintings. Paintings that were painted by Irish artists. They weren't all living in Ireland. Some of them were living in France because, you know, they were mm-hmm. part of the French Impressionist period. They weren't French Impressionists. But they were part of the period they painted. They lived in Brittany. They lived in England. They sold in England because there weren't too many Irish who were buying paintings. Back when these guys were and women were painting in the 19th century, thinking about the ones that Brian has mostly in his collection go from about 1850 onwards. And he tries to stay in the 19th century. That's his area. So he has built up a considerable collection over the last 40 years. And it used to be way back in the day when people would come across a painting in Ireland, there was a big old house being sold or whatever, and there'd be a big painting in there, and they would say, it was, you know, of a sad scene, a famine eviction scene or something sad and kind of very, very pathetic, but beautifully done by a skilled artist. The dealers would say, well, who would want this? And all of them would answer, Brian Burns. Brian Burns. Because Brian had, you know, he had been interested. And he had been interested because his grandfather was a motorman in Boston. And he respected his, who was an immigrant. And he respected his grandfather's, famine immigrant. He respected him so much that he wanted to honor this in his own way. Yeah. So with that, he built up this extraordinary collection. And the collection was first seen at the McMullen Museum in Boston. And from there, over the last 25 years, Brian doesn't show them very much. There's 12 of them hanging in the consulate until the end of June. That I've been up now since March for the last 3 months. And I went, Brian invited me down. He said, you know, he had wanted to loan some of the paintings so we could bring attention to John J. Hughes.
Now, you're talking about the Irish consulate.
Yeah, they're at the Irish consulate. There's 12 of them at the Irish consulate, along with the Hughes exhibition.
That's here in New York.
Here in New York. And the point, the reason that I brought them in was to show the Ireland that Hughes came from, these paintings, communicate that. One painting, as you enter the exhibition, one painting alone is of a ball being held at Dublin Castle. That the costumes are so incredible, magnificent. It's been held in St. Patrick's Hall in Dublin Castle, and it was painted in 1848 at the height of the Irish famine. So a million people were dying outside. And inside this ballroom, people were all dressed up to the nines.
Mm.
And it just shows the great imbalance that the British Empire had to the citizens of the country they were supposedly governing. But, you know, to stand on Brian. So Brian built this collection up. He brought he allowed the paintings to be seen in maybe about 8 museums around the country and also in Ireland. Over the last 20 years, they went to the Hugh Lane Gallery in Dublin.
Yes.
And Mary Robinson opened it there. They were paintings that were used when Jean Kennedy Smith did the festival at the Kennedy Center in Washington a few years ago, and I had the privilege of working with Ambassador Smith on that. And they opened a new gallery at the Kennedy Center just to show Brian's paintings.
Mm-hmm.
So he has these beautiful paintings by artists like Jack B. Yeats and John Lavery and James Brennan and Sean Keating. Some of the loveliest paintings that have been produced by Irish artists. And Brian has this magnificent collection. So I've been trying to tell this story, and every time I think I'm finished with the documentary, something extraordinary opens up again, like the concert in New York. So we wanted to capture that on film as well. So we keep adding on little bits of it. But Brian keeps saying, when is this going to be done? So it's going to be done soon, but we just story continues, Adrian. What can I tell you?
You know, we can't talk really. Whereas the the Burns Library at Boston College and the collection of Brian of Brian Burns, we should really though acknowledge that perhaps the best collection of Irish paintings anywhere this side of the Atlantic is, in fact, at Quinnipiac University, our own.
Absolutely, and that's open to the public, weekdays.
Weekdays, and it's free.
And it's free, it's open, it's free. And they have, Burns gave them a gift of two works of art. One was a beautiful painting by James Brennan of that's just a wonderful big picture. And just recently he gave them a gift of a bust of Jack B. Yeats. So they're on display at the Great Hunger Museum in Hampton, Connecticut, on Whitney Avenue. And that is such a treat. I know, people from New York take up, like a coach, go up there as a group. They go to the museum, the playwright bar and restaurants across the street. They go and have lunch there and make a day or an afternoon out of it. But it's just something extraordinary. Halfway between New York and Boston, we have a museum that celebrates Irish culture, the deepest end of Irish culture, in an extraordinary way. I understand the museum just got an award this week as a great for best design and layout of a museum. So I have to hear more about that, but I just got an email saying that they got a big award this week. So, good things are happening, Adrian. The important thing is we're getting closer to our history. And we're able to talk about our history, and we're able to celebrate our history. And God knows, maybe our history will be able to inspire other people who are going through the conflicts that we've gone through.
Now, you have continue to act as a contributing director of special features for Irish American Magazine.
Right.
And produce special supplements.
Right.
And overseeing the content design and all aspects, indeed, of the of the production.
Features in the magazine occasionally, yes.
Now, just coming back to Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday, that seems, what are the hours? Where is it being held?
Well, it's a full list of programs. It starts at about 9 o'clock in the morning, and then you have a couple of brilliant speakers. You have Professor Mary Hickman, who's and you have Marion Casey, who people know from New York University. So you have panels. You've got panels of people like that. In the afternoon, you have Patty Fitzgerald from Ulster University, great guy. You have this extraordinary guy, Warren Hofstra, who I know now over a couple of years. Warren especially is all about the Shenandoah, because this goes into the Civil War and to the southern states as well. So for people who want to come to it, I suggest that they simply look online and go into Ireland's Great Hunger Institute, not museum, Institute.
Okay.
And they will get all the information, and there's a button there that takes you to the Ulster American Heritage Symposium. If they even went under that too, they'll find it.
Yeah.
And then in there, there's a place where you can register for all 3 days, and or maybe maybe just send an email and say I'd like to come for one or two. But you can see on that website all of the different panels and who's speaking. And I have the pleasure of being there on Friday. And I'll probably talk about what the things you and I are talking about right now, but I'll be able to show pictures.
The details, just for those who are listening to this program here, the details are on our website as well, and that's irishradio.com. We thank you for joining us today, and again, we're getting smarter. When you come on this program here, you can definitely, you know, give us a lot of information.
Okay. Well, Adrian, something happened. A pigeon, a dove just flew into my kitchen.
Go. Okay, thank you. We'll see you at Quinnipiac University. Our friends there, and a very, very active indeed organizer in the Irish American community there, Tarnlough McConnell. Friends, if you're listening to us and you'd like to switch over to 11 uh, 6